Hey folks, you're listening to a special 9-part series on gender, gender politics, and gender equality. Obviously, you can do what you'd like in terms of how you listen to them, but I've designed these to be listened to in order. Each episode builds on the last one in a logical way. Think of it like you'd think of a book. If you take things out of order, a lot of it is going to be hard to understand or just seem off. So if you've just stumbled into this episode, please go back to the start. Otherwise, thanks for listening to everything in order. Let's get into it. Does anyone need any retrospectives? It's like last time on Pan Political.
Yes, please. That sounds great.
Last week on Pan Political. We brought our previously deceased lead characters back from the dead because we realised that we had no further material and neighbours.
Awesome.
Do you need an actual catch-up ever?
I was just wondering what that would involve and now I know.
I did too and I was like, nah, I should focus, but I love it. Thank you.
With that out of the way. So for today's episode, I'd like to tackle the question of why is this perspective so different? And by this perspective, the stuff we've been talking about over the last half a dozen episodes or so, which will be the most normal stuff in the world for some people, but which will be quite new and quite unusual, almost to the point of, in my experience, cognitive dissonance. For some people. So cognitive dissonance is when something makes sense, but it goes against what you believe or your felt sense of things, or perhaps just what you've been immersed in the whole time. And that's, yeah, you have an internal dissonance of how to make those things match up. So I know from past experience that at this point in time, some folks might be having cognitive dissonance or just a little background question of why is this perspective so different to what I'm used to reading? And I think part of that is because I think it's very clear in the things we've been talking about that we, this material and the way we've been talking about it, we're clearly not coming from a sort of a perspective of men's rights activists, and we're clearly reasonably well informed about women's issues and have a lot of care there. So that also separates us out from the way some of this stuff is spoken about some of the time. So to explain that, I'd like to look at it from the perspective of the research and publishing cycle. So the way social research is done and published. And I think the stages of that cycle might be defined as the initial inspiration, getting funding, releasing that information or that research, having articles written about that research, and having those articles read. So I'd just like to work through those cycles and how gender stuff plays into it. So the first one is having the interest in the topic and having the inspiration for the research. So most primary research comes from academia or government and sub-government and or philanthropic sources. And there's also like a couple of think tanks and other sources out there. But the main ones would be academia, government, and philanthropy. And although we're in a world which is in many ways male-dominated, those areas are not, or at least not in terms of the politics of the people there. It's unusual in those areas to find people that are wanting to signal that they have an interest and a compassion in men and men's issues, either instead of or as well as their interest in women and women's issues. Maybe just as a little example of that, I don't know where it's up to at the moment, but as of a few years back here in Melbourne, Australia, there was heated debate in universities around whether in amongst the context of a degree in gender or women's studies, whether there should be a half a day on men's issues. And there was a lot of debate around that. And I don't know, like I say, I don't know where it got to. It didn't look to me like that was actually going to get up. So that's not the kind of environment where you're going to want to signal to the world that you've got an interest in everyone's issues. The second area would be getting support and funding for whatever research you want to do and releasing that. I don't have any statistics on this, but it's certainly my belief that a lot more funding and support exists for women's issues, by which I mean social research, which is built around the impacts on women. I've worked in the third sector, so government and the non-for-profit sector, quite a bit. And I've looked at a lot of grant applications and funding sources and things like that. And it's quite common to see caveats in funding sources around, like in terms of the fine print, that the research or that the funding must produce positive outcomes for women and minorities, or even language like can't be shown to have adverse findings is language which is around the place, which basically means can't be seen to clash with the core values of the funding source or the philanthropic organisation or so forth. And if you go to those core values, they're going to be things like protecting women and minorities and so forth.
It's almost like women are the minority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And when you look at it at the government level, so I'm talking state or federal, at both of those levels in Australia, we've got actual women's departments that have generally got veto rights on things that are going to have adverse findings. And although men are everywhere, there is no men's department. There's not that same veto procedure. And a lot of people assume, I think, that because men are everywhere, then men's issues are everywhere, but they're really not. So I've got a couple of examples to support what I've just been claiming. Which is one example is that when I was working with a large, like one of Australia's largest not-for-profits, aid organisation, I guess you'd say, they'd received federal government funding to look into human trafficking. And I was chatting with someone who had done that research and it was all completed and done, but they were not allowed to publish it because it had, quote, adverse findings, unquote. And so what they'd found, they were studying all possible cases of human trafficking in Australia over a three-year period, deliberately trying to obscure some of the information here. They discovered that there were approximately 70 cases in total in Australia of people who were trafficked, humans that were trafficked. Three of those were female. They were all in the sex trade, but they all wanted to stay, and they wanted to stay in their current role, and they didn't want any intervention or support. The rest of the cases were all male, generally in agriculture or other sort of regional type of hard manual labour type of situations. And about half of them wanted help, wanted assistance to get out of their situation. They were like tricked into a situation and they wanted assistance getting out of it. So there was a line in the contract wording about adverse findings, which meant that because that those findings ran the risk of shifting the attention away from the plight of women and human trafficking of women, they were not allowed to publish that information. So the people I spoke to about it were just absolutely furious. Like they were beside themselves with rage because they had frontline visibility on what was happening and that significant harm was being done, but they couldn't do anything about it. I fact-checked this because, as anyone close to me, including myself, will tell you, the last thing we want to be relying on is my memory, especially of events decades into the past. So I did a little researching on this rave I went into about forced or slave labour in Australia. And long story short, it seems to check out. You can do your own research, and I strongly recommend you do if this topic is of interest to you. There's one particular article I found on the ABC's website. For those of you not in Australia, the ABC is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is Australia's government-funded broadcaster, generally charged with the mission of reporting all things in Australia in a fair and representative way for all people. The article in question follows the story of one particular person whose story just happens to pretty much exactly match the theme I was talking about from about 15 years ago. If you want to have a read of that, do a search on the ABC website for the article on Moturaga. That's Moeturaga. More broadly, there's a whole body of articles around inquiries that have happened into modern slavery and forced labour in Australia, often relating to the use and misuse of people within the PALM visa program, which is short for Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, which is a program to give Pacific Islanders employment in Australia. I read quite a few on the ABC's website and looked into some other sources as well. And at first, I thought that this was wonderful because it looks like all that stuff I was talking about from 15 or whatever years ago has been published and it's been aired transparently and is now out in the open. And that sort of looks to be true, which is great. But because I started with the knowledge that the gender split on forced labour in Australia may have been something in the range of like 95% male and 5% female, I was immediately interested in seeing if I could prove or disprove that number. And this is where it gets kind of disturbing. In my research, it is almost impossible to find those or any gender numbers. The gender numbers have been obscured, which is exactly what my colleagues in the not-for-profit sector were saying to me decades ago, what they were so frustrated about. Think about this with me for a second. It's my belief, so, you know, not a true thing necessarily, but it's my belief that if the numbers were the other way around, so if women made up, you know, 95% or something like that, of forced labour in Australia, then that would be the lead. That would be the headline. And probably as a result, many of us would know about it. But because the victims in this situation are mostly male, the gender analysis seems to have been obscured. As a consequence, most of us just don't notice that men might be victims. We only ever see reporting showing us that women are victims. As a consequence of that, it just naturally feels like men win at pretty much everything and women lose at pretty much everything. I'm exaggerating, of course, because it's not that extreme in practice, but I think you get my point. In the interests of fairness, I should declare that I haven't had the time to do a real deep dive and to properly and fully research this particular situation. Nor is it anywhere near my area of expertise, and nor can I immediately think of anyone in my network who I can have a quick phone call with for guidance, someone that is an expert in this area. So pretty big caveat there. But in general, it feels to me like this fits a pattern where information showing men as victims is one way or another less likely to be aired or reported as a gendered issue than information that shows women as victims. So, yeah, with that massive caveat that I haven't been able to do a full research deep dive on this, it kind of looks like my claim holds up.
So that's one example. Another example which folks listening along at home can do, you jump onto Google Scholar. And there's a few different ways you can approach this, but my suggestion is see if you can, what we're trying to ask here is how much research and how much research money is thrown at stuff which is principally about women or women's issues and how much is principally about men and men's issues. And there's no super easy way to do that. When I was researching for this, I did a search on, quote, impact on women, unquote, compared to impact on men, to see how often those phrases come up. And the ratio there was 207,000 hits on impact for women and 14,000 on impact for men. So that's a ratio of about 95 to 5% in terms of what's being written about, which to me feels approximately representative of what I generally see around there. But I think the funny thing there is it's not like we start with a 50-50 level of interest where both issues are looked into in approximately equal measure. It's just that there's so much more harm against women.
I think there is so much research out there that just never even contemplates that an issue could be of harm to men. It starts from a different basis point. This is my request for your support. You may recall my first request at the start of this series was almost apologetic. I wasn't sure how the content was going to land, nor did I know how comfortable you'd feel sharing it with others. I suggested you might want to merely say to others that this is something they might find interesting. By the time episode 5 came out, I had received in-person feedback and I could see the number of listens going up. I got confident enough to acknowledge that many of you were sharing it and many of you wanted to support this endeavour. Now, as I edit the last 2 episodes of the series, it couldn't be clearer. Something about this is right, and something about the timing and the format is also right. The feedback I'm getting and the numbers I'm seeing could not be clearer. So I'm leaning into this pan-political thing. Let's do it. I'll say more about my plans in due course. In the meanwhile, as I step up, I want to ask you to step up with me if you haven't already. There are 3 ways you can help out if you're willing. Option 1 is to do what you've already been doing. Share this with anyone you can think of that might be interested. Option 2 is to leave a review, especially on the larger platforms like Apple or Spotify. Option 3 is that I've finally set up a Patreon page. This allows you to contribute financially. Up until this moment, I've been doing the podcast for love alone. I will continue to do so. However, love is a limited business model. With your help, we could do more. I'll put a link to the Patreon page in the show notes, or you can navigate to patreon.com/curiousconversationsaboutsex. Thank you.
But back to that, baby, looking for circles. We see a lot of circles everywhere.
Yeah.
Looking for triangles. Like, genuinely, it's quite a fun thing to do at home, isn't it? If you have a look around the room that you're in, you go, oh, I'm like, circles are it. Circles are the thing. And I can see quite a few circles, and I can see things that are definitely circle adjacent. And then I go, no, circles aren't it. Triangles are it. Like, yep, I can see triangles there. I can see triangles, even the shapes of the things leaning together, etc. So you can see triangles or squares or whatever other thing you want to put into the plan. You might go rectangles or circles.
Yeah.
It's really easy to find a lot of that proof when you do it.
Wow, yeah, I love it. I'm just doing that around my room at the moment.
Trick, isn't it?
Look for things that are black. Look for things that are white. Look for things that are coloured. Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly that.
It's quite,
So as a result of that, because that thing around the funding of research and releasing it, so much of it is just looking for one particular thing, then that tends to be what we see. So if you're just having a casual look at the media around you, you're looking at a ratio of 95% to 5% at best, which makes things look extremely tilted. And they may or may not be that tilted, but yeah, I don't think they're 95 to 5%. I've got another little example. I don't know if you recall that during COVID, it was pretty widely reported that levels of domestic violence and partner violence skyrocketed during that period. And that was generally reported as a national tragedy, etc. It turns out that wasn't the case. That was not based in research, and the information is out there. If you want to have a little bit of a search, there's really good data out there showing that there was no spike. But of course, that piece of information never got published. So there's a lot of people that are under the impression that COVID was horrible for women, and in so many ways it was. But the story is a lot richer than that.
Any concept why did it? Did someone just feel bored and feel like reporting on that, or do we know how it kicked in?
I've read about that. I don't have the information intimately enough in my head to answer that question. I suggest that the listener has, if they're inspired, does some reading around that. But yeah, it seemed to my eyes to be a legitimate path, like legitimate enough. I'm happy repeating it here. Just as an example of if there's a finding that shows, it's like you've heard the phrase, like if it bleeds, it leads. I think actually more accurately, it would be if she bleeds, she leads. And so that initial story of feeling like that was way worse from a partner violence perspective, that was fabulous reading because it got us all engaged and compelled and shocked. But to follow that up with saying actually that didn't work out to be the case, that's not going to keep us compelled. No one would read that. So that's what I'm thinking of as the support and funding for research. The next step is around getting articles written on that research. So if researchers actually get their information published, if you have a look at, I know it's a gross oversimplification to break the media up into stuff that's on the left and stuff that's on the right. So this is a gross generalization. Obviously, I think it's obvious that the left is compatible with women's issues and are unlikely to publish stuff which is about men's issues or that shows that men are having a difficult time. And if they do, they're unlikely to frame it as men's issues. I think some people sometimes assume that the right wing is the opposite of that, but I'm not sure that's the case. I don't spend a lot of time reading right-wing media, but in my experience, they very rarely publish anything that's pro-men, but they are a little more reluctant to publish pro-women stuff.
The moment that would be more an anti-women stuff, wouldn't it? Depending if we're falling into the anti-abortion and pro-life, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it still seems to be women-focused. Just the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, yep. I think that's definitely there. I think even the right-wing media has a general background awareness of women's issues to a degree, but yeah, I think you're right. I like what you're saying. The right-wing probably about going to have a mix, but still within that mix, it's extremely rare to see what you'd regard as a men's issue or a pro-men piece.
Yeah, it seems funny, that not funny at all, sad that there's like anti-women stuff, like it's not your choice and so forth. And yet there's not really pro-men stuff unless you're going to the extreme Andrew Tate's of the world of the pro-men stuff. But there's not, yeah, I haven't read lovely articles just describing about it's this wonderful thing where men are flourishing in such and such a position, and haven't seen that very much.
Yeah. No.
From any part of media.
No, I think it's worth remembering that the media is not about providing us with balanced information. It's about selling advertising, and the best way to do that is to keep us engaged on the platform. And the best way to do that is to feed us stuff that we passionately already agree with, or make fun and humiliate the stuff that we disagree with.
Or vehemently disagree with, so that we'll get all riled up about it.
Yeah, yep. And I think that most media would be, particularly in the current climate, would be very keen to avoid the risk of being labelled misogynistic and then have advertisers cancel and subscribers cancel. And in the current climate, any interest in men's issues does get labelled as misogynistic. I've got a couple of examples. One example is I was contacted by a journalist who was writing an article for either ABC Australia or The Age newspaper. She wasn't sure which, but that was her general. That's who she normally writes for. And she was wanting to write it about cheating and affairs. And she just flat out refused to have male subjects. The only way she could write that piece is to have female victims of males that had cheated on them. So that's the pitch she made to me. So I said, oh, what if we just do this with all genders? And she just really simply said, there is no chance that will ever get published.
Wow. That's sad.
Another example from my own experience, I know that, like, I haven't done that much writing, but I know that writing stuff on women's issues is the easiest thing in the world. Like, it's both easy to do emotionally, because I know that I'm not about to get a resistance or backlash, and it's also really easy to get it published. And there's also perhaps a niche in the market for men writing about that stuff. So maybe there's even like an extra layer of advantage there. I know that stuff that's in the neutral, like I've written some things on sex positivity, and stuff that's neutral about gender is reasonably easy to get published, but I've never had anything published on what you might regard as being like positive about men or talking about men's issues compassionately.
A little side note on this is that when I owned a magazine and we would try to put different people on the cover, we noticed over years of it that people definitely worked better on a cover than any just art or anything else. It was really good, and we really often had to have a human looking at the prospective reader was one of the best ways to get a cover sell. We often tried to put people of different genders and different races on there, and we could see the sales plummet when we had males on there. We had people writing in going, why aren't you putting enough males on there? So that was interesting. People were writing in and complaining about that. We went, all right, we'll put more males on. Every time, it definitely did not sell as well. Anytime we had a male on the cover, which was really strange to me. We didn't have enough budget to be able to find out why or any of those things, but it was always so annoying to me that we just had to have a female on the cover to be able to get people to purchase the magazine.
Yeah.
Or pick it up when it was even a free one.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah, it was very perplexing and annoying, but I feel like it's, I don't know, it's almost, oh, let's not look at men because then we might have to think about them or something. Like,
I know we've spoken before about Mona in Tasmania for other reasons. I haven't been there yet. I understand they've got a wall of casts of vulvas on the way in. And I know that's framed as saying that's a process of catching up with the position and the freedom and the normalcy that men enjoy with regards to their genitalia. I actually think the truth is that people would feel assaulted if they went in, there was a whole bunch of dicks on the wall. Whereas when they're vulvas.
Yeah.
It doesn't even have warnings. There's no warnings there. I took a small person there once and it wasn't my small person, obviously, because I don't have those. And I had to check where that was explicitly so that I could avoid that because they were six. And I didn't have their parental permission to do that, but there were no warning signs around there. And if I hadn't asked, I would have known. So we would have just happened to cross it.
Mm. Amazing. So,
yeah.
Yes, it'd be an unsolicited dick wall assault if it was. Yeah.
Yes.
I once tracked, this is slightly off topic, but I once tracked, I felt that when I was on Facebook, I'm not on Facebook anymore because I can't stand it. When I was on Facebook, I felt that I was seeing a lot of memes that felt like they were either pro-women or anti-men or both. And I couldn't quite tell to what extent that was my trauma and I was just looking for squares. So I was just seeing squares. So I did a really calculated, very careful analysis over the course of 4 weeks. And basically the average was that every week there were about 12 gender-based memes coming through and 10 or 11 of them were very specifically anti-male and maybe one of them was neutral and the other one or two were pro-female and maybe one of them was neutral. I'm not quite sure that's relevant to media, so that might not make the edit, but yeah. Another one that is a little more on track. As a matter of course, quite a bit of information about the world of the globe comes from the United Nations and just as a matter of policy, they include always pointing out women and children, so we often see news stories that include, say, bombing in such and such a location, including women and children. That's something which flows all the way down from the United Nations as a matter of policy. And perhaps as an example of that, we've got two wars. There's more than two wars going on. There's two that are dominant in the media around Australia. One of them is Israel versus Palestine, and the other one's Ukraine versus Russia. It often gets reported that the Israel versus Palestine situation, I saw the other day that it includes, I'm sorry to laugh, none of this is laughable material. I saw a reporting the other day, the wording was the majority of people were women and children. In any given civilian population, the majority of people are going to be women and children. You could also say the majority of victims are men and children because that's two out of three groups of people is going to be the majority. The reality is there's a slightly higher percent of women than men being killed in that war, something like 52 or 53%. But that compares to the opposite situation in Ukraine versus Russia, where, as we've discussed on a previous episode, it's something like more than 99% men, male victims to 1% female victims. But that's never been reported on as a war on gender. So,
Archie. A question.
Yeah.
It's fair to say that you're creating media that is solely about men's issues. Are you expecting any censorship?
Can I just, that's an excellent question. Can I just go back?
You may.
I have a really funny relationship with.
I'm happy to word it in a different way.
Yeah. It's really funny because I know that a lot of what we're talking about here is about the impact of this stuff on men and men's issues.
But it is broader than that.
It's broader than that, and it's clear that we have a perspective where we care for everyone. And most of the reason why we're interested in men's issues is because I think that leads us to solutions for women as well as solutions for men. So there's something really unique about this approach, which I don't see in much of the media around me at all. Most media just catch slams on one side or the other. So even though I absolutely agree with you, and I have that going off for me as we go through this quite a bit of, oh God, this is a lot of talking about men. It's also not. The only reason it's interesting is because it's a benefit to anyone. With that said, do I expect censorship? Yeah, there's a reason why I have to do this myself on my own channel, because any media organization that has a gatekeeper will not touch this. And I've had articles get to the stage where they've been approved and someone on the editorial board has said, yes, this is fascinating, but because they present a nuanced perspective on things, including, not limited to, but including that men may be victims, they get cancelled before they get published. Yeah. And in the next episode, I'll talk a little about me personally and what I expect to happen from this series.
Nice.
Okay. Dropping in to add in a little to this question. It's been on my mind since we recorded it, which was 6 months ago in my version of reality. The question from Inga was, quote, "It's fair to say that you are creating media that is solely about men's issues. Are you expecting any censorship?" End quote. I think this is fascinating because from my perspective, this podcast series is a long way from being solely about men's issues. If I take the second episode on privilege as an example, in that episode, we explore how women have got privilege in some areas, but not in others, and how men have got privilege in some areas, but not in others. So without going back and literally scoring how much time we spend on each of those sides, at least in the way I think about it, it's very even. Also, the whole series is built with a very dualistic approach. We're asking what are the problems faced by all genders and how do we come up with solutions that work for all genders. And my own personal position is also pretty dualistic. I don't care about men any more than I care about women or any other gender, which is to say that I care about them all a lot. I care about everyone. But, so, how does this make sense? I've heard responses like Inga's before, and it's come up for me in other conversations that I've had around these topics. And I think I know the reason why, or the reasons why. The first reason is that some of this comes down to what you're used to talking about and what's familiar to you. I think most people are steeped in media and conversations that naturally include a lot of women's issues. So much so that it's just part of the landscape. But since it's what most people like, most people just don't notice it. It's a normal thing. In my experience, I'd say it's common for a comment about women's issues or a joke about men to find their way into a surprising amount of conversations, a surprising amount of the time. However, when you make a comment about men's issues, it really stands out because it's not what people are expecting, nor is it what they're used to, and perhaps nor is it what they like. So you can be in a conversation which is actually mostly about women's issues, bring up one men's issue, and get a response that implies that you sort of never shut up about men's issues. So that's one reason that stuff like this might seem like it's all about men. A second reason is that, particularly in the circles I move in, and let's call that, you know, the progressive left as a approximation, we have as our baseline a pretty extensive and nuanced understanding of women's issues. I would say the vast majority of us are actually very well-informed feminists. So a lot of what I find myself doing conversationally and also here on this podcast series is responding to what is really a baseline of a lot of dialogue about women and women's issues. Like, let's take the wage gap as an example. I would be surprised if there's a person over the age of 15 in Australia that hasn't heard of the wage gap, and I would say that the vast majority of people would agree or would have an understanding that women simply get paid less for the same work or, you know, something like that.
As we explored in episode 6, the situation actually seems to be much more complicated than that. And to solve the actual problem, we need to look right into that complexity. So this involves deviating from the norm and looking not just at the ways that women are the losers in a given situation, but looking at how we are all both winners and losers. If you are so thoroughly immersed in women's issues that you don't even really notice when one pops up in conversation, because it's just really normal for women's issues to pop up in conversations, but at the same time, if you've spent little or no time looking into men's issues, then you are really going to notice when a men's issue pops up. In the case of the wage gap, it might look like I'm relentlessly banging on about men's issues and that I'm a men's rights activist. I find this really sad, though, because I'm not. The only reason I want to look into the complicated nuances of the problem are because I want to get it solved for women and, yes, also for men. If the only thing that you are used to is women's issues, it will look like I'm the representative for men's issues. It's just not true, however. There's one third and final idea I've got on this, which is like the way heterosexual people sometimes tell gay and lesbian people to stop putting their relationship in everyone's faces, for instance, by kissing in public. Gays and lesbians will sometimes respond by pointing out that heterosexual love is everywhere and that gays and lesbians are just joining in on the public displays of affection party. It's just that when they do, it stands out because it's not welcome rather than because they're doing anything differently or wrong. So I'd like to make the same parallel with men's issues, I think, which is that women's issues are, at least in my bubble, more or less everywhere. I'm not doing anything differently when I also talk about men's issues. It's just that it stands out because it's not welcome or not what people are used to. Oh, I know I said that that would be the third and final point. That was before I remembered that the fourth and final point, which is about context. If you put me in a room of people that are only talking about men's issues, and especially if they're only talking about them from a one-sided perspective, then I am going to look like that. No, I am going to be that person that only ever talks about women's issues to rebalance that field. And in fact, I'm going to look way more brazen and demanding about how I talk about women's issues, because the reality is I am. I actually find that a much easier topic to talk to and to get passionate about. The thing is, it's rare for me to be in those spaces. And this podcast series is mostly responding to a world that's much better informed about women's issues than it is about men's. So yes, here as well, I find myself doing a lot of that rebalancing kind of a role. But again, it's only in the interests of finding solutions for all parties. Back to the recording.
The summary on that one is around, so that sort of subtopic is on getting articles written about research. And I think one of the things here, we all know the media is really biased, but I think that something people don't think about a whole lot is that it's also really biased around gender. Like, I think a lot of us think we're getting an even and balanced exposure to gender issues via the media we read, and I don't think that's true.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So the next subtopic is, if someone does write an article, the process of getting those articles read. And I guess I'd invite the listener to have a think about the articles that you have read and what you've clicked on recently. And do you reckon it's approximately even? Do you reckon you get a roughly even spread of sort of women's issues, men's issues, non-binary issues? As one of my colleagues said, I think I've mentioned this before when we were talking about this topic, they said that they don't need to read about men's issues to know that there are no men's issues. And I think that's a little extreme, but that's a perspective that a lot of people occupy. There's just zero interest. Yeah, maybe I haven't spoken about it before. This was a reasonably influential influencer talking to the topic of gender and equality and justice and so forth. And I asked them about something because they said, in my opinion, some really blind spot offensive things.
And so I politely, gently, we had a great conversation in the background, but their initial position was, I don't need to read about men's issues to know that there are no men's issues. And we eventually did get it around and they apologized. But yeah, that was their initial position.
Wow. That's interesting to hear that someone would say it so bluntly, as in, I would imagine that lots of people actually think that without realizing that they
think
that.
You know, I agree.
Like they just accidentally have gone, oh, there's nothing men, like it's all the women's problems, etc. So I think probably heaps of people think that without even necessarily realizing they do. But to say that, wow, it just strikes me as shocking a bit.
Yeah, I was surprised to find someone that would admit to it or that was like aware of it and actually bordering on proud of it.
Yeah.
Actually, there's no bordering on it. They were totally proud of it. Ooh. Yeah.
And righteous about it or just, I don't know, it's if I were to say something that I, in my ears would be equally stupid, it might be something, or stupid's a bit rude, but if I go, oh, there's no, I don't need to read about wars in Palestine or anywhere there, or Israel anywhere there, because I know that there aren't any. So that's just me proving my ignorance or something. I don't know. It's just perplexing.
And when you've got that kind of perspective, it's very self-fulfilling. Because needless to say, it is going to look like there are no men issues. Mm. If you literally make sure that you don't read anything to do with that topic, it's like when people say we can't use the word sexism to describe what happens to men. Then what do you know? It looks like there's no sexism against men. The word sexism and how we use it is a fascinating little side journey I want to take you on. You almost cannot find the word sexism in any mainstream media, anywhere, used in relation to what happens to men. You almost cannot find it. If you do, it will be heavily guardrailed or qualified. For instance, you might find something described as being like sexism, but against men, or that something is a form of reverse sexism, meaning that the sexism only really happens against women, or that something is sexist against men, noting that almost all sexism is against women. As a result, it feels like sexism only really happens against women. So it feels like that's a word we should only use when we're talking about what happens to women. Which means it feels like sexism only really happens to women. So it feels like that's a word we should only use when we're talking about what happens to women. You get my point. It's a self-fulfilling loop. It's a media cycle that creates its own story and then reports on that story. Speaking of stories, now it's time for a story. I was chatting with a friend once. She told me that there was a lot of sexism in her workplace. I wasn't sure what she was talking about, so I asked, do you mean sexism against women or sexism against men? It would seem she was so horrified by the fact that I might use that word in relation to both women and men that she took it to her counsellor, who also happened to be my counsellor at the time. I hadn't realised it was a thing, but sometime later, after one of my counselling sessions had ended and I was leaving, my counsellor called me back and said that it would be better for everyone if I didn't use the word sexism to describe what happens to men, only women. You could see this as a gentle favour done for free, but you could also see it as a breach of ethical conduct. Maybe both. I don't know. Regardless, I note that my friendship with the person in question effectively ended around that time. And my counsellor dropped me as a client a little bit later. So it's possible that me having an interest in sexism against both women and men cost me a friend, and perhaps contributed to costing me an incredibly good counsellor. I've had stuff like this happen a lot. It's a strong motivator to only use the word sexism to refer to what happens to women, which makes it look like there is no sexism against men, and we shouldn't use the word for that. And on it goes. You get my point.
Sad.
Very self-fulfilling
way of looking.
Makes me cross. At least when I'm ignorant, I'm not ignorant. At least when I'm, when I make a statement like that, if I was to make a statement like that, and I don't generally, but if I used another example, I'm generally doing it really on purpose, knowing I'm wrong. It's a completely different way to use that. That's if I was to say something like that, it would be on purpose, very provocative, and completely knowing that I was wrong. Like I couldn't ever say these people of any particular kind of group have no issues because I know it's wrong.
Yeah.
I just know that.
It's getting on willful ignorance.
100%. That's deliberately being, and I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
That's the bit that was unsaid at the end is, and I don't give a fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also on that one at the moment, if you do research on ChatGPT, and this may evolve and change over time by the time it gets to listeners because those bits of tech are still pretty new at this stage, but they have guardrails around men's issues. I know we've spoken about this before. So if you do research looking for information on women, it just gives you the information unqualified. If you ask for information about how things impact on men, you'll always get a couple of paragraphs at the end that say, and remember, gender is a complex issue and issues affect all genders in confused and interesting ways. And we need to make sure that when we're pursuing one issue, we don't accidentally drop other important issues. And
which is good information in itself.
Yeah, it'd be good if it applied to everyone.
Exactly.
You can force ChatGPT to give you that same information about women's issues, but you have to specifically ask it to, like it was talking about men's issues.
Wow.
I've actually done that experiment.
Fun times. All right. So next subtopic or last subtopic is if an article is actually written about research and process of, say, getting it shared and recommended amongst circles and communities and so forth. So with the stuff that we're talking about here, when I actually sit down and have long-form conversations with people about what we've been talking about, it's actually really unusual for me to find people that aren't at least approximately on board and have, and in a lot of cases have already been doing thinking about it. But the chances that of people actually, say, sharing an article about this sort of stuff on their own Facebook profile or whatever is almost zero. It takes a profound amount of courage to speak up and to risk being cancelled or ostracised and to deal with the takedowns in an environment where people are pretty hostile and pretty stubbornly uninformed and will also potentially make themselves look good at your expense. So public shaming for caring about men, essentially. So I know that in the course of regular conversation, I think, and this could be me completely deluding myself, I feel like I bring up men's and women's and minority gender issues approximately equally evenly or something like that. If someone says something stupid about women or if someone's suffering under something, which to me clearly seems like a structural disadvantage or a sexism against women, I'll comment on that in the same way I will for men. But I know that people will sometimes feel like I'm only commenting on men's issues because they're so used to living in a world where we just consistently comment on women's issues. So people have got like a very different amount of tolerance there. I also know that I have come out as queer. I've come out as a sex worker. I've come out as a sex educator. And for most people, the big one, I've come out as non-monogamous. But out of all the things that I've come out as, by far the one that has been the hardest, and I mean by far, is as someone that cares about all genders. And it does depend a little bit on context. So it depends on what circle you're in. But yeah, generally speaking, that for me has been by far the hardest one. And in the editing process, I will probably actually drop this section of an episode in. But if I don't, I will just direct the listener to, there's a podcast called You Are Not So Smart, which is about social research showing, as the title suggests. Okay. The podcast I'm referring to is called You Are Not So Smart, and it's a very strong recommendation from me. It's all about psychology, and more specifically, the ways we delude ourselves. Perhaps the concept of confirmation bias is one of the best known of these, whereby we have a belief and will then pay much more attention to articles that support our belief and either not just not read or find ways to disregard articles that disagree with our belief. It's amazing. For copyright reasons, I'm reluctant to drop the section in question into this episode, so I'll just describe it instead. It's in episode 276, and the relevant section is around the 24-minute mark. It's talking about how we're social creatures, we're tribal creatures, and how, historically, it's been crucially important for our individual survival, our survival as individuals, that we fit in with the rest of our group, our tribe. It's so important, in fact, that it's more important that we change our beliefs to fit in with those of the group, because to disagree is to risk being rejected from the group. Historically, this could easily mean death. So we have an extremely strong motivation to be seen to be going along with the group and not causing trouble. We would rather die than do the wrong thing. For if we do the wrong thing, we might as well die. This explains why our shame response is so strong and why we are almost constantly virtue signalling, by which I mean we are constantly signalling to the group our virtues, by which I mean the reasons why we're a good person, the reasons why we should be kept around. When it comes to gender politics, if you lean to the left side of politics and the people around you lean to the left side, it's important that you signal your understanding of women and women's issues. You can do this by occasionally mentioning misogyny, patriarchy, or privilege, or perhaps by making jokes about men. Talking about dad jokes is a nice, easy example. If someone makes a comment in favour of men, or that sounds like they might not understand about women's issues, that's an opportunity for you to gain incredible rank and standing within the group by showing that you're not just aware of the relevant issues, but that you're willing to go into fight for the group. A great way to do this is by rejecting the person in question or criticising them in public, like on social media. I've always thought that if someone wants to sort something out with you, they'll get in touch privately. If they want to just score points at your expense, they'll humiliate you or outsmart you on social media. I honestly don't know how this plays out exactly on the right wing of politics. I don't spend much time there. I don't think it's quite as simple as saying that the right signals their virtues by speaking on behalf of men and men's issues. I don't think it's as simple as that. I think it's probably more a question of signalling that one doesn't care for gender politics at all, or that you think it's just a big old storm in a teacup, or something like that. I'm not sure. It's easier to imagine the right virtue signalling around gun rights or freedom of speech, perhaps. Either way, to not do so is to risk death. This whole situation, by the way, is the cause for a lot of cognitive dissonance, which is where you have a belief, and you absolutely have to make sure that your group knows that you are believing in the right things. So when someone says something that makes sense, but that goes against your beliefs, it puts you in one hell of a conundrum. You wind up heavily in cognitive dissonance, where a belief that you have is clashing with credible information. Most people come up with some pretty strange defences of their beliefs at this point in time, or they go on the attack against the person that said the thing rather than addressing the actual thing that was said. Like if it's too hard to attack the issue, then attack the person. Sad. But fortunately, not everyone does that. I reckon we're growing out of the stage of our evolution as a species, where our survival depends on going along with the group on everything. I am forever heartened by people that can set aside their beliefs, give you a smile and say something like, huh, never thought about it that way. Or, wow, that's going to take some digesting, but thanks for speaking up. I love those people and I love that aspect of humanity. It is a pleasure to walk the earth with you. And I'm not for a second trying to imply that I consistently get any of this stuff right in terms of my own behaviour. I'm human too. So yeah, I really recommend episode 276
of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. Actually, I want to say that again. That cannot be accurate. Most people would figuratively rather die than admit that there's something, there's a truth or a point of interest in some of the stuff we've been talking about if it runs the risk of social exclusion. Like, we are so influenced by what we're going to get good feedback for. And that's why virtue signaling is such a thing. And particularly in the left, which is the world I generally occupy, it's extremely unpopular to talk about this stuff.
And everyone, regardless of the topic, humans are very geared towards how do we look good or avoid looking bad. You know, it's a super core gearing of most humans to go, what can I do in this situation, that's in whatever situation, to look good or to at least avoid looking bad. And so if suddenly talking about men's issues go, oh, hang on, I might be looking bad there, people will run a mile from it.
So at the end of that publishing cycle, it begins again. Like, the general landscape, it looks like after all of that filtering, it looks like there are no men's issues, and it looks like you'd have to be a fool for thinking there are. And so no one thinks to research, no one thinks to publish, no one thinks to fund. So it's a very, very self-replicating model. So it tends to look like a conspiracy, and I'm not saying it is. I don't think it is, but it has the same effect. It also looks a lot like propaganda. So by propaganda, we think of that in the context of war, when you release one side of the information, which is likely to have the effect of making your population furious to the point of being willing to go to war against another population. So you need to present a very exclusive side of the story and present it in a way which makes the listener furious. And when I look at the way gender issues are presented, I feel like it's got the same feel as propaganda. As I say, I'll talk about this more in the next episode, but I've been running a business on sexuality and sex education for the last 12 or whatever years, and I couldn't have done this series while I was still running that business, because the knock-on effects and implications on my business and me would have been too great. I'm in a position now where I don't care. So yeah, it's a stunning demotivator to look into this stuff. Also, to express an interest in this stuff and be willing to face the backlash, which is generally going to sound something like, you're going to be treated like you're stupid for thinking that these issues are real, or that you are arrogant for thinking they need to be dealt with. You actually need to be a stream of toxic masculine to be in that space. Like, you don't want to have emotions and speak up about this stuff. Yeah, which is sad, because we miss the opportunity to fix the problem. So here's a fun little exercise. We're nearly finished with this episode. Here's a fun little exercise for the two of you and for listeners at home. If you imagine you were a woman, would you believe a man that says he's open-minded and loves women, but that refuses to look at women's issues? Would that be a bit of a red flag for you?
Might be a little hard to believe those two things are true at the same time.
Yes.
Properly.
Yes. And so I guess the question is, why is it different the other way around? Because,
the answer is it's not. Well, I don't believe it is.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is. I think having no interest in women's issues is a form of misogyny, and having no interest in men's issues is misandry. And I think that's all there is to it.
I've seen it play out in people's relationships where either way, they're clearly not interested in the inner world and the disturbances that their partner is of either gender is experiencing, and either doesn't believe them about things like, yes, I've experienced sexual assault. If we go the more typical man, woman, a woman experiencing a lot of sexual assault, but also a lot of, I've seen it the other way in women not believing their partners who are men who've experienced a lot of emotional abuse in their life and sexual abuse and stuff as well. So I've seen it both ways play out, and it's never ended well for the relationship.
Yeah, no.
we need to have an understanding of the issues that affect our partners and the people around us, which are theirs to deal with, but not necessarily their fault.
Exactly.
So normally we finish episodes with a bit of a sense of what the solutions are and what the ways forwards are. But in this case, that's what the next episode is going to be about. So let's leave that one there for today. Okay. So by way of balancing comments and responses and clarifications, I think today I've got one response and one sort of thought, or I don't know, additional point, or just pulling something together a little better than I might have during the episode. The response first. So there's a voice I can imagine that I know is out there, I've heard from before, particularly I'd say in response to today's episode, and like why this perspective is in some ways so different for a lot of people. And the response is something like, yeah, some interesting points, but if this was true, like if this collective opinion that you're representing here, Rog, was true, then gender professionals would agree with it. And this would be the take on things that gender professionals would be pushing. And I think I kind of associate this thinking a little bit with perhaps the way we think of, or at least I think of, scientists and climate change. Like there are some scientists who either don't think that climate change is real in the way it's generally described in the mainstream, or think that it's so much more complicated or nuanced that effectively they disagree. And if you've been tracking the climate change debate over the last like 20 years, there's a frustration because that 1% of scientists or like climate scientists that disagree with the mainstream of thinking have gotten an astounding amount of airtime and have really derailed the movement in a lot of ways. And so I think that there's certainly some people that view my perspective or what we've been listening to in this podcast this way, as if it's just a sort of a 1% of, let's call me a gender professional just for the sake of this conversation. There's like 1% of gender professionals might see the world this way, but, you know, they're just an incredibly fringe minority. And I think what I'd say to that is actually, I think plenty of gender professionals do agree, either with this material as I've presented it, or would say something like, yeah, the situation is actually way more complicated than what's generally represented in the mainstream of gender discussion. And I think that that number is nothing like 1% versus 99%. However, I think that for a lot of people, it is like that around them. And perhaps, dear listener, if you are struggling to wrap your head around the, you know, difference of perspective that this podcast series represents, then perhaps it is like that around you, in that all of the gender professionals you hear from, all of the discussions you take part in, all of the articles you read, and all of the books you've read or whatever, have that kind of 1% to 99% tilting. I think we live in a world that is mostly referenced around women's issues. I would say absolutely nowhere near enough. There is so much more work to be done. There is so much more awareness that needs to be brought to the women's issues that we are aware of. And so much more work needs to be done to research and articulate the rest of the issues facing women. So on the one hand, I would say there is much, much more work to do there. And I'm 100% behind that. However, the world is much more referenced around women's issues than it is compared to men's issues. If we're talking about gender professionals, I think plenty of gender professionals think that the situation is very complicated or much more complicated than the mainstream of gender thinking or something like that. But as we've discussed in this episode, the same stuff applies to them. In a lot of cases, they can't risk speaking up or disagreeing, their own need to fit in with the group and keep their employment at times means that they can't risk speaking up or thinking differently. If they do, they're going to have a real struggle getting funding for their research. If they get that funding and do it, they're going to have a real struggle getting published. And if they do get it published, it probably won't be read. As a consequence, for a lot of people, it really does look like it's a 1% versus 99% kind of a situation. And it also may look like I'm being kind of delusional or stupid for not spotting what seems so obvious to people, which is that it's a man's world and women are the losers. While that is true in some ways, and that is true in some places, and it is true for some individuals, while there is truth in that statement, it's not necessarily obvious to me. I think what is obvious to me is that someone that holds that perspective and that that's the totality of their perspective is probably surrounded by one side of the story. It's not so obvious to me that that perspective is correct, or rather it is correct. It is correct in some ways and sometimes in some places and for some people, but it's not obvious to me that that's the whole of the story. I think the whole of the story is much more complicated. So that's my response to that perspective, and it sort of leads me on a little bit to a thought on media. And I want to talk also about my use of the word propaganda. I read some fascinating research not so long back. I don't have the exact reference I can point you to, but it should be quite easy to find. The research was relating to the Boston Massacre. And again, I'm right outside my level of knowledge here, but as I recall rightly, that was a sport event, like a marathon. Perhaps it was a bike ride. I'm really sorry for forgetting the details. And at the end of that, there was a shooting incident, and from memory, tens or dozens of people were shot. It was a really bad shooting event in Boston, America. The research in question looked into the level of trauma response that people had following that event. There are ways you can measure trauma. Won't go into it here. That's for a psychology podcast some other time. But you can measure the level of trauma a person carries after an event. And the absolutely fascinating outtake from that was that people that had consumed 90 minutes or more, so that's 1.5 hours, people that had consumed 1.5 hours of news coverage of the Boston Massacre were more traumatized than people that were in the Boston Massacre. So think about that. I think that's interesting to think about in terms of the media around us and what tends to be in the media. I would say, based on the media around me, and I live in my bubble, you know, my bubble won't be the same as your bubble. Maybe it will. Maybe yours is more intense than mine. But I would say that the media around me is absolutely awash with women's issues and is actually bordering on desperate to be able to present issues as women's issues and to present women's suffering. as I've said in this episode, the media around me is extremely reluctant to talk about men's issues or to talk about them as men's issues. And so I suggest that as a compromise, as a consequence of that, to some extent, we all have to be deeply, deeply traumatized about women and women's issues through this strange secondary kind of mechanism. And I'm not saying, God knows I am not saying that there is no original source. God knows I'm not saying that there is no source of trauma for women and that there are no women's issues. That is not what I am saying. But what's interesting for me is the amplifying and exaggerating effect of the media that's around us. And I guess I say that because when I attempt to say something like, you know what, I think the situation on gender is quite a lot more complicated and nuanced than most people give it credit for, I guess it's that same role I was just talking to a moment ago. That role, that person will look back at me as if to say, are you crazy? Do you not see the level of trauma in the world as like a placeholder of evidence of who's got it worse? I just want to say, yeah, maybe. But the amplifying effect of the media, as per the example of the Boston Massacre, distorts this kind of first glance, intuitive, our hunch on who's got it worse. It's actually really interesting from the perspective as a therapist. So, you know, there's different modes of counselling and psychology, and the stuff that I've been trained in isn't going to be the same as what you've been trained in and so forth. There's no absolute rights around this. But one of the things I was taught in therapy, particularly with regards to trauma, is that if you, no, I'll speak in the first person, if I, as a therapist, only support my client in their pain and in their victimhood, I'm actually failing them as a therapist. So if someone comes out of a difficult relationship and the only thing I do for them is say, yes, that was horrible. Yes, you've been hard done by. Yes, this was horrible. If that's the only thing I do, I'm actually failing them. At some stage, I need to circle them around and connect them with their power, with their agency, with their choice in the matter, perhaps with the things that they did to contribute to the situation, perhaps the things they need to do differently next time. If I don't do that, I'm setting them up for future failure. And I'm also kind of committing them to... That's just a really difficult space to have to sit in with no movement. So from a therapy perspective, I don't think any of my teachers actually said this, but to summarise, and probably badly, it's dangerous, it's irresponsible, it's wrong to only support someone in their pain and in their victimhood. Supporting them in that has to come first. You have to get a person safe, get them comfortable. You have to hear that pain and that victimhood on its own terms, in its own words, at whatever pace and style it wants to come out. That's the primary thing. That's the first thing. But at some stage, you need to step in and form some sort of alliance with that person's power, and you need to bring their power into the room. Otherwise, I'm failing my client. And I would say, circling back to the media, I would say the media is failing us at the moment. It's not just the media, it's us. Every time we click on one particular type of article, not only do we encourage the media outlet to continue to produce more of that, but these days we also are fine-tuning the algorithms to make sure that we continue seeing more information about that. And so it goes on, and so it goes on. And I don't have an absolute answer to this, but I think there's something important for introducing diversity into our media feeds. One final thought. I mentioned in this episode the word propaganda, and I think it kind of flows on from this these thoughts on media pretty naturally. So the word propaganda, as I understand it, I always think of it as a term that's used in wartime. And it's generally an intentional thing by a government who will put out one side of the story in such a way that makes the other side, or the other country, as is often the case in a war, which makes them out to be pure evil, and which makes your side out to be the innocent, good-hearted victims of a situation. And we all know this concept. It's not that hard to do. In the case of war, you might report on an incident where the other side came and committed some horrible, egregious act against one of our people, someone from our side. And that's the end of the story. And the nature of propaganda is that you don't mention that that was in response to us going over and doing exactly the same thing to someone from their side. So the purpose of propaganda is to make our people, your people, angry, scared, to feel like we are being attacked and that we have to defend ourselves because that is the just and right thing to do. And ideally, that our survival depends on it. So that's how propaganda is used in war. As you've just heard me talking about in this episode, in some ways, I think a similar thing happens in gender. In that, in the same way that, say, for instance, our media almost just will not use a word like sexism to talk about men and women, and will generally not report on stories that show men to be victims, or that they're suffering, or that they're challenged, or that they're not privileged in some ways, or that they need help. And if it does describe those issues, it's unlikely to describe them as collective men's issues. So you might notice there's a lot of crossover and things in common with the way propaganda works in war. Now, there's a huge difference here. There's a massive, huge difference here. Propaganda is an intentional, coordinated thing, generally from the government or the, you know, ruling military or something like that. And there's no, to the extent that this same analogy stacks up in the gender debate, there's no coordinating body with that specific intention. So there's a huge difference there. However, the effect is very much the same. There are a lot of people, and I have been one of these people earlier in my life, who show all of the signs that's of someone that is in a war. So the media world around us makes us feel like we're under attack, makes us feel like it's unfair, makes it feel like the other side has everything, are keeping it from us, and makes it feel like our existence is threatened, and that if we don't go into battle, we will die. It's very effective. We are now in a gender war. Thanks for listening, friends. This is my request for your support. You may recall my first request at the start of this series was almost apologetic. I wasn't sure how the content was going to land, nor did I know how comfortable you'd feel sharing it with others. I suggested you might want to merely say to others that this is something they might find interesting. By the time episode 5 came out, I had received in-person feedback and I could see the number of listens going up. I got confident enough to acknowledge that many of you were sharing it and many of you wanted to support this endeavour. Now, as I edit the last 2 episodes of the series, it couldn't be clearer. Something about this is right, and something about the timing and the format is also right. The feedback I'm getting and the numbers I'm seeing could not be clearer. So I'm leaning into this pan-political thing. Let's do it. I'll say more about my plans in due course. In the meanwhile, as I step up, I want to ask you to step up with me if you haven't already. There are three ways you can help out if you're willing. Option one is to do what you've already been doing. Share this with anyone you can think of that might be interested. Option two is to leave a review, especially on the larger platforms like Apple or Spotify. Option three is that I've finally set up a Patreon page. This allows you to contribute financially. Up until this moment, I've been doing the podcast for love alone. I will continue to do so. However, love is a limited business model. With your help, we could do more. I'll put a link to the Patreon page in the show notes, or you can navigate to patreon.com/curiousconversationsaboutsex. Thank you.